Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And the quality of my voice is a little different today. I've forsaken upstate New York and my office with its high-tech equipment, and I'm taking a vacation and a little bit of work in Florida. In fact, if you happen to be in the Tampa area, I'm at Safety Harbor Resort and Spa at the annual Florida Adlerian Society. Adlerians come from the traditions of Alfred Adler, which are very, very positive and, in fact, set up much of what we call humanistic psychology today. And on Thursday here at Safety Harbor at the Adlerian Society meetings of Florida, the Safety Harbor Resort and Spa, I'll be talking about really a workshop on Thursday about the problems in giving psychiatric drugs to children. What does it mean about how we view children? What are better ways to view children? And then for the second half, one of the Adlerians will be joining in to talk about better methods of child rearing. He's a great speaker. Dr. Walton, a marvelous fellow, is going to be joining me. And that's on Thursday. That's on Friday. And then on Saturday, I'll be part of a plenary panel talking about an overview of where in the world we should be taking mental health. So that's what I'm doing this weekend, Safety Harbor at the resort and spa at the Adlerian meetings, the Floridians. But don't forget our upcoming empathic therapy conference. Once again, it's April 26th, 27th, 28th in Syracuse. Go to empathictherapy.org or go to my website and find your way there. It's a great conference. We think we're going to just about fill this year. We have wonderful speakers. So I'm really, really looking forward to that and to just having a ton of people come on in and visit and talk and listen. People will come to that conference, to our empathic therapy conference, feel like it's a healing experience. Now, it's not a lot of touchy-feely. We don't do a lot of that. I think one of our speakers maybe encourages us to say hello to your neighbor or something like that. But it's a very supportive, caring environment that people really, really enjoy. Now, my guest today is Ethan Waters. Let me check. Ethan, are you there?
I'm here, Peter.
Oh, good. Ethan is one of the most interesting people I might get to interview. His book, Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche, is one of the books to be read, one of the handful of books in the last 3 or 4 years that should be read. Crazy Like Us. He's a journalist, and by the way, Waters is with two T's, Ethan Waters. He lives in San Francisco. His book, we'll get to talk a lot about, but it's just full of important, important information. It's about how, in a way, like a plague, we're spreading the Western viewpoint of psychiatry around the world. And his emphasis is a lot on the cultural effects of this, the psychological effects, what it means to import into another country, how you view mental health and mental illness. And I hope we'll talk about something I know very little about and could learn about, which is some of the different cultural views on mental health, not just mental illness, but mental health. And he talks about, just to sort of prime this a little bit, he talks about the stigma of brain disease. Something I've said for a long time is that to tell people they have brain disease is instead of emotional problems does not liberate them. It does not help people think kindly of them. It doesn't make people less afraid of you when you've got a brain disease rather than an emotional problem. There's a whole bunch of stuff, including the evolution of what now we call PTSD. And I might be in for a bit of a shock around this, because I've often said that post-traumatic stress disorder, while not a disorder, while being a human reaction, the normal brain, normal person to unusual stress, just a plain old human reaction, one of the things he suggests is that even that is colored by cultural definitions and expectations. So, hello, Ethan Waters, journalist from San Francisco. How you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
Well, I'm really excited about this. Where would you like to begin? You can pick up on anything I've said or wherever you'd like to begin.
Well, I think that, you know, I do think that issue of stigma and how we attach names to mental illnesses and this idea we tend to promote in the West, which is this notion that if we define this as a medical condition, as a genetic, a biological state, that this will naturally reduce the stigma attached to these illnesses. And you know, this has been studied fairly extensively in many, many, many countries. And what happens, it turns out, is as countries adopt the biomedical narrative about mental illness, stigma tends to go up. So people think of that illness as or that state as more intractable, more dangerous, more permanent. And
probably more like an illness, which the language you're using.
Exactly right.
They think of it as an illness rather than, hey, Joe's got a problem.
Right. And so I think, you know, this notion that, you know, if we just spread our ideas around the world, stigma will go down is certainly problematic. Now, that said, I do think these things are culturally, you know, stigma certainly is culturally based. And I've had, you know, as I've talked about the book around the country, I've had people come up to me and say, you know, that diagnosis of major mental depression actually saved my life. It's the thing that my family understood. It's the way I present myself. So it's not all of one thing, of course. For some people, that belief or that set of ideas around an illness could indeed in some cases be destigmatizing. But I think when you take this aggregate studies about both our culture and other cultures, you find that the stigma tends to go up when people adopt these notions, not down.
Well, I think it's an incredibly important point. I think it's also a pretty obvious one that has just been missed by the American Psychiatric Association, the National Institute of Mental Health, the NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. They've all been pushing these ideas partly on the grounds that people are going to feel better about themselves and other people are going to be less stigmatizing, hostile, rejecting, and it just, of course, it just doesn't, as a general principle, turn out to be true. And in addition to that, it justifies, I don't think logically, but it ends up justifying them locking people up against their will and treating them like Alzheimer's patients who don't know what they're doing and can have their rights taken away from them. I'm talking about severe Alzheimer's patients, you know, and who really need benevolent taken care of rather than to be treated as independent human beings.
That's right. We have such certainty about these that the rest of the world needs our ideas about mental illness. We think of them as not based on culture, as based on some sort of notions of absolute science. And my point, you know, is in the book, is that we'll really never understand these diseases unless we understand how the symptomology is shaped by the cultural understandings. I think PTSD is certainly a really interesting example because within our culture at this moment, with so many soldiers coming home, we think of it as a sort of a solid state disorder, a thing that has this list of symptoms, and we recognize it. And certainly many, many soldiers coming home these days will be displaying those exact symptoms, defining their lives in terms of this. But if you look at battlefield trauma over history, if you look back, say, at the Boer Wars, you know, soldiers would complain of pain in their joints. If you look back at the Civil War, a soldier would be complaining of irregular heartbeats and pain in his chest and homesickness. If you look at the First World War, you have a shell shock, which would be, you know, displayed in terms of physical paralysis or body movements and tics, sort of like hysteria of the time. So we can see two things. One is that it's clear that battlefield trauma affects the human psyche, and that, the consequences will be bad, and oftentimes. But when the mind becomes unstuck, when the mind looks for how do I express this distress to my time, to the people around me, the healers, my parents, and society, the unconscious mind goes looking for the language of suffering for its moment in history, and that changes from time to time. And the important point is that, you know, people often mishear me at this point. They think that, oh, well, it's the soldier's choice then to express, you know, PTSD. Well, it's not. It's just what the human mind does when it has, when it's in distress. It looks for, it's the language of the moment. It looks for the, you know, what medical historian Edward Shorter called the symptom pool for its time. There's a certain number of symptoms that will be accepted at that moment in history as legitimate, and the unconscious mind will gravitate towards them. And this is an unconscious process. It's not under the control of the person. But if you look across history, it becomes very clear that that's what's happening.
Just as an aside, Shorter's not a great hero of mine. He's done a lot of historical work, but he's also the author, along with David Healy, of the single most pro-shock book written in the last decade. So he's
right.
A big pro-shock doc in Canada, along with David Healy, who is in some areas a reformer, but in this area of shock treatment, he's a real biological psychiatrist. And
very interesting, yeah. I would assume that you and Healy would have lots of points in common, but I suppose that one would not be one of them, of course.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, Healy is and wants to be a biological psychiatrist. He doesn't believe in or do psychotherapy or look at things from a social or cultural viewpoint in particular. He's a biological psychiatrist who just has, you know, moved into the arena of some of the adverse effects of psychiatric drugs, but he's very pro shock
right.
treatment. But just a bit of an aside there. Now, one of the things we see that's characteristic of the soldiers who come back and get diagnosed with PTSD is that they often have recurrent night terrors. They can relive the experiences, and they may even awake with a kind of hallucinatory state. And in light of what you've been saying, I've been trying to think back to the readings I did. I didn't have any direct experience with the world, much anyway, with the World War II veterans. And I don't remember that being reported as a characteristic response. Do you have any recollection about that, Ethan?
Yes, I mean, the idea of the flashback, actually, you know, and of course soldiers have troubled memories, so whether, you know, this notion of flashback, that you would go back into this moment in time and you'd be unable to escape it, and mentally, it really, people have written about it in terms of its connection to cinema, like the flashback in cinema. Like, so this is a cultural notion that suddenly you can be in the story of your life and then suddenly be back in another story. That's a story that became prominent in cinema, you know, in the latter half of the last century. And it also became adopted as sort of a PTSD notion as well. Now, that's not to say that a soldier in the First World War wouldn't have had vivid recalls or troubling, you know, memories or nightmares. Oftentimes, you know, the symptoms will be on the list if you could find them in literature. But oftentimes, the important thing is not like whether a nightmare is on the list as a symptom, but whether it's at the top of the list. So, if you go to Sri Lanka and you gave Sri Lankans after the tsunami, and this is what I write about in my book, the PTSD checklist, they would acknowledge most of those symptoms, but they wouldn't be if you developed their symptom checklist, which is what some psychologists did in Sri Lanka, understood what was important in their culture, the symptoms on the PTSD checklist would be very far down the way, and what would be at the top of the list would not be mental states that were distressing, but the idea that you cannot fulfill your role in the group. So they have a much more sociocentric conception of the human mind. It's not an individual idea of the human mind. And because of that, they get their greatest distress and their greatest trauma from a tsunami is losing their place in the family or being unable to fulfill their role in the society that they had before. And that's something that you don't find on the Western checklist, but it's critically important to understand sort of where these symptoms rank in terms of a given population and how they believe in them.
This is, you know, this is just incredibly interesting. And one of the things that occurs to me as you were saying that is that, of course, people after trauma, particularly after wartime trauma or economic trauma, they do, in fact, in the West, feel the loss of their role in society if they can't work or they can't be a decent husband. And it may even be one of the reasons they get suicidal. But they're not necessarily going to frame it that way.
Or they're going to frame that as an ancillary symptom. So it's, I have PTSD. Oftentimes, I'd better take time away from my roles as a father or a worker or something to look at this, you know, with individual counselors. So that's a Western conception of the human mind existing sort of apart from others. To suggest that to a Sri Lankan, to say you need to take time away from your role as to heal from this particular disorder, that would make no sense to them at all, because the primary symptom is their inability to fulfill that role. So you'd basically be suggesting the disease itself at that moment, where in the West it makes much more sense. And this is not to say that we in the West have it wrong. We in the West have a different conception of the human mind, a different conception to what happens after trauma. So the symptomology in the West makes sense to us. Oftentimes the treatments in the West make sense to us. So my book was mostly about, you know, when Western trauma counselors rush into a place like Sri Lanka, like, are they doing more harm than good? And my suggestion is that we better be very, very careful when we take these ideas across borders.
Well, I have perhaps less of a tendency to be relativistic, because I do think there are some truths about human relationship, and I think I think that the Sri Lankans maybe are teaching us something, because the whole problem, I was thinking about this yesterday, I was mulling on this yesterday, that here you come out with this DSM, and it's got all these individual diagnoses in it, and yet everyone who's ever looked deeply at human life, I think just about everyone sees it in terms of relationships, sees it in terms of human beings growing together, learning together, children being brought up by adults, and then children becoming adults and bringing up their own children, and all the relationships and the teaching that goes on. And in my own work as a therapist, what the Sri Lankans are saying fits exactly with what I would say. If I had somebody with, when I do have a person who's very upset and injured emotionally, I always try to work with them with their family, that they're not having an isolated experience, so that they're growing closer. So maybe there's also some lessons from these differences, and that we're essentially imposing not just a Western idea. I think that demeans the West. I think we're imposing an atomistic view of human beings, which is not necessarily in the best of Western traditions of knowledge, religion, understanding, philosophy, that psychiatry is simply, Western psychiatry that's being imported, simply so backward intellectually. Am I going too far for you there?
I don't think so. I've thought about this same thing as well. I'm not sure I would lay the blame necessarily at the door of psychiatry, but I do think in the West, you know, from psychiatrists to people in general, we do share a more individualistic sense of the independent sense of the human mind. We think of ourselves as captains of our ships, you know, steering our way through the world, and that really fundamentally makes us different than the large part of the world who thinks of themselves as interdependent on the group, on their role in the group, and so forth. It's a different way of thinking about the human mind. And the question becomes, which goes to your comment, is it possible that that's just not just another way of thinking about the human mind, but an incorrect way of thinking about the human mind? That is, even as we're striving for this independent notion of ourselves, we desire connection. We need the sense of connection to community, to others, and that the myth of the independent mind is actually the cause of a lot of our psychopathology and struggle in the West. And I do think in that sense that other cultures that live in an independent, you know, that have a more interdependent understanding of the mind do indeed have something to teach us here.
Yeah. Yeah. I would also say that I think this idea of the independent American has been misunderstood and exaggerated in a bizarre way, to some extent, by the intellectuals of the country. Americans don't think like that, actually. maybe a few atomized people in the big cities, but Americans in general are very community-oriented. They deeply believe in taking care of their families and often their neighbors. You go back to the origins of the country at the time of the Revolutionary War, while the emphasis was on individualism and liberty, mainly liberty, in response to the whole oppression and the whole concept of no, there's a political liberty, people were deeply imbued with their communities. I mean, these are the people who were involved in writing the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, even though they were all males, were very, very much involved in their communities. So I think there's also a risk of caricaturizing Western individualism, and I think psychiatry is just dumb. You know, the more I look at what my profession's doing, it's just dumb. These ideas of diagnosing a person outside their family context, their life context, their history, is just, it intellectually stands alone as a foolishness about human relationships. I don't know, I'm waxing about eloquently, I hope, about this, but it just has been really occurring to me, and you're stimulating me to think a lot on this show today. So let me be quiet and let you talk some more, Ethan.
Well, I think, you know, I do think that's interesting. And, you know, I've been writing about psychiatry now for over 20 years. I began, you may or may not know, writing about the recovered memory controversy in the 1990s, which is a time when many women, and mostly women, but some men, were going into therapy and uncovering memories of what they thought were having been abused in the hands of satanic cults. There was this remarkable rise of the what was then called multiple personality disorder and now called dissociative identity disorder. And there was this remarkable cultural phenomenon there in the early to mid-90s when many, many people believed that this these satanic cults were everywhere and that all people were running around with multiple personalities. Though that trend, you know, in the mid-90s suddenly died off. And what I find remarkable about it is that you talk to therapists about it today. I don't know what your opinion about this topic is, but you talk to most people in the profession today, and they say, "Oh, yeah, that was just this crazy thing that happened in the 90s." And now we know we're past that trend. And there's something about the profession. If I had one critique of it, it seems to reinvent itself every generation in such a way as to turn a blind eye to its past abuses. And you can go back, you know, certainly through the early drug therapies and to lobotomies and to electroshock and recovered memory therapy. Every generation seems to have this remarkable thing happen to it by which the next generation says, "Oh, yeah, well, we don't do that anymore, but now we know." And they act like suddenly it's a profession that's not at the whim of cultural trends. And I think with the drug therapies and certainly the treating of children with stimulants, I think we're going to look back on this in 10 or 15 years, and then once again it'll be, "Oh, yes, well, that was crazy. But now we have something really to offer." And I think until, you know, the profession begins to have a memory of the abuses it's done and to be able to understand why those abuses happen, because I think it is a matter of being carried away by cultural currents of the moment, that is not going to be able to fully gain legitimacy, and certainly not in my eyes.
Well, again, I agree with you a lot, but I think you're much too kind. you know, the only reason we don't have lobotomy today is because I took about 5 years out of my life, went broke, devoted myself entirely to stopping the resurgence of lobotomy around the world, worked with Congress, attacked the federal government for what it was doing, testified in court, won the first lobotomy suit ever won in court, but way earlier than that, you know, was a key expert in a case that stopped lobotomy in the state hospitals and the federal government, the VA. So,
well, I know a great deal about your work, and it's
so
not,
I don't think they just said, "Hey, guys, this was crazy."
No, they did.
It drove them out of doing lobotomies.
It requires a tremendous amount of work for, you know, some brave practitioners, some journalists, some lawyers to change any of these things. What I'm talking about is 10 years later, when whether anyone really is at that point taking responsibility for what went on.
Oh, they never.
I'm not saying these things stop.
No, they never go back. And we still have so much shock. Even we still have all the shock treatment going on. So it's not like they say, I mean, I would put it a little differently. It's not like they say, "Hey, guys, you know, that was a mistake." They never say it was a mistake.
They just ignore it altogether.
They ignore
right.
it.
Right.
And they perpetrate it if they can.
Yeah.
So I'm a little more bleak on it than you are, but I think that you're making what you're saying is so important, and God knows you've gotten me talking more than I do on my shows. I usually give my guest more time. tell us some more about about what you've been learning about this. I mean,
absolutely. I mean, one of the things I think I can get fairly quick agreement when I say something like, you know, depression is shaped by our cultural beliefs about what sadness is. And people, if I give a couple examples, I talk in the book about Paxil going to Japan and how GlaxoSmithKline fundamentally changed the Japanese conception of like where the line was between pathological and non-pathological sadness. I can get pretty quick agreement that,
yes.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yes, that must have. I bring up something like anorexia, and they say, oh, yes, culturally shaped. Yes, I can see that too. When you begin to talk about things like schizophrenia, People begin to think, well, surely there are mental illnesses that are beyond the reach of culture. They have no connection, and if you ask them to name one, they'll probably come up right away with schizophrenia. And the most remarkable finding in the entire literature of, you know, cross-cultural psychiatry is a WHO study that charted outcome rates for people with schizophrenia around the world, and what they found was this remarkable result, which is that in the West, in the industrialized West, you have the worst outcomes in the world, and oftentimes the better outcomes are in developing nations. And of course, there is the possibility that it is literally the drug therapies themselves that are causing a deterioration in these patients.
But there's no doubt about it.
Well, I think that's one possibility.
That's half of it. Yeah.
Yeah. The other possibility is. You know, and I went down all the way down to Zanzibar off the coast of Africa to spend time with an anthropologist down there who was looking into the ways in which the culture down there understands the illness, and they understand it primarily as a spirit possession experience. And that in some places would be a very stigmatizing notion, and indeed in some places even in Africa it is extremely stigmatizing. But in Zanzibar, the particular way these beliefs are employed tends to keep that ill individual within the family group. He's like us, only more so. So it keeps them within the group. It doesn't allow the family to see that individual as an other, as a defective person. And she believes that that is part of the reason for the good outcomes in other cultures, which is that they basically have not adopted that biological notion of mental illness. And even for things like schizophrenia, the outcomes tend to look better. And this goes to a whole list of research.
We got to go to break.
Yes.
You can pick up on these thoughts. I think it's this twofold thing, that Western medicine destroys people's brains and makes them much more worse off with time, not better, but worse. And that these cultures, they do. They have family support systems. They have social systems. My guest, Ethan Waters, will be back shortly. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, and I'm having a wonderful time talking with my guest, Ethan Waters, with two T's, W-A-T-T-E-R-S, a San Francisco journalist, author of a very very enlightening book, Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Ethan, where are you? What do you want to talk about?
Well, but just briefly talking about schizophrenia and how it has a different manifestations across cultures. And I think, again, as you suggested with the Sri Lankans, that the people in Zanzibar have something to teach us about it. And there's a very rich literature in what's called expressed emotion among family members. And what they've discovered is that when someone with schizophrenia is surrounded by family members who are highly controlling or highly monitoring or overly careful, full of care for their individual, the symptoms of schizophrenia tend to be worse over time. And I think when you test that, why people would do that with a schizophrenic, what you find is that the people that have that high levels of expressed emotion tend to be also people that have a belief about the human mind, that the human mind is always in control. The person should always be in control of their thoughts and their feelings. And in places where that's not true, and Zanzibar would be one of them, where you have this notion of the permeable mind, the permeable to the spirit forces, to the community, people are not so much in charge of their own emotions. You tend to have lower levels of expressed emotion and better outcomes with schizophrenia. And again, I think there is something about that other view of the mind that I believe in the end of the day may be just more accurate. I think the mind is permeable to the cultural beliefs around it. I think we are less in control of our thoughts than we think we are in the West. And I think if we have a fuller sort of appreciation of that, we might look at people who have even less control than we do, or who are suffering from something like the symptoms of schizophrenia, we might have a great deal more compassion for them and less of that high expressed emotion, where we demand that they keep their thoughts in order.
Yeah, I, one of my favorite phrases is that we're made of each other. You know, we're made of each other's bodies. We're made of each what we're taught and brought up to feel and to think. Human beings are creations of each other. We're social creatures.
Absolutely, and we do that on a conscious level, and more importantly, we're doing that on an unconscious level. I mean, there is a fascinating new research coming out of what's called cultural psychology that suggests that the culture influences our cognition in far more basic ways than we have ever understood. You know, most mm-hmm. psychological testing, in terms of the university testing has been done, 96% of it has been done on Western individuals, something like 90% of it has been done on Western college students.
College students, that's right.
And yeah. But just recently, literally within the last 20 years, they've begun to take these tests about, fairness or visual perception or all these other things that we thought were basic ways that the mind work. We're taking them across culture, and we're discovering to our amazement that the reactions are far different than the range of reactions to these tests is far different than we thought. Even things like visual perception, which I find very interesting. If you learn to see like your culture, you learn to think like your culture on very fundamental levels. And I think that research is just fascinating, but it does speak to your point, which is that the people around us shape us far more than we understand consciously.
Absolutely, and my marriage to Ginger has incredibly shaped me for the better. People who like me now probably wouldn't even like me before I met Ginger. So I mean, we really have the possibility of harming each other greatly and helping each other greatly. I wanted to return to one thing just to clarify a couple of issues around the multiple personalities and the ritual abuse. A couple of things I want to just quickly address. They may or may not be worth your responding to. One, there is no doubt, of course, that sexual abuse of children is rampant.
Absolutely.
Yes. So I want to. Yeah. I thought you would knew that. I knew you would knew. I knew you
yes.
know that.
Right.
I just wanted to make clear that you weren't.
It's important, and also the other important thing is that it's common for the mind to not think about something for years and years, to re-remember it again, and to categorize it as something important, and to have a very big reaction to it. The recovered memory therapists, I don't know if you want to get into this, but at the time were saying something really rather specific. One, and they went like this. They said it was possible for a child to be ritually abused, like, and that for every instance, the child would instantly forget that abuse, as in wake up the next day and go to school. And then the 30 years later, when they went into therapy, the therapist had the power to pull out those memories in crystalline form, like in perfect, you know, you could remember the dialogue, you remember everything. And if you take those aspects of what they were selling to their clients, that instant forgetting and the remembering with full detail, there is no scientific...
No evidence for that.
No
evidence. I think it's concocted. It's a way of making another way of making a living as a therapist.
So there's where I would slightly disagree with you. I think most of these therapists were misguided but terribly sincere. They were not simply out for the buck. They certainly were making money doing this, and I don't want to let them off the hook for that, but they were very sincere. And they
I'm so much more cynical than you. Everybody's sincere.
Yes. Well, that's true. Yeah, evil people are really easy to see coming. It's the people that want to do you the most good that you have to really be careful of.
Sincerity is not one of my measures for anything.
But it wasn't simply about money. It was, I think there's something about the therapy encounter that can make it a lightning rod for the cultural fears and beliefs of the moment. So there was a lot of interest in this. You know, you remember Sybil and all these, you know, there was all the, it was
now
famous,
the,
it was on the TV
the Eve,
every day.
Wasn't the guy who did the Three Faces of Eve and then whatever it was, 6 or 10, he was a shock doctor, wasn't he?
I don't know that off the top of my head, but I would not surprise me.
Yeah, I think he was. I mean, these forms of abuses are so intricate. So I want to just again confirm something, because it's so important for people in therapy. Yes, abuse exists. It exists. It's rampant, and it has terrible effects on people, and you may not remember all of it. And then recover some memories of it later on.
That's right.
But it's highly unlikely that you had multiple extensive abuse experiences without remembering them as horrific.
Right, or having some deep impact on your childhood or your schooling, and the idea that you would remember that your parents, you know, were involved in a satanic cult that killed babies when you were, you know, and you were remembering this when you're 33.
Yeah.
Seems like, at least, especially from this distance, now that we can see...
No, I think that is
very unlikely.
Not the way it happens. It does, however, happen that there sometimes are groups of adults who are involved in abusing children.
Undoubtedly.
And in that case, it can have a ritualistic quality, but it is not generally wholly forgotten and then remembered in great detail.
Right.
And it is... And you can see it impinging on the person's life from the very beginning of their lives as they struggle with these dreadful effects. So
it is
the
very
other thing, one nice thing I wanted to comment on, I think this whole thing about multiple personalities was a concoction that brought a lot of fame and fortune. And I think what it amounts to is that when a person comes to you after they've been through horrific experiences, they're going to react at one time one way, at another another way. At times they're not going to hardly know why they're doing what they're doing. Our job as therapists isn't to, quote, differentiate their multiple personalities. It's to help them be a whole person.
Right.
And I think these people were taken advantage of and taught that they had multiple personalities.
Well, you know, there were some leading clinicians, you know, that would have whole client lists who would be multiples. Of course, none of them would have known their multiplicity before they entered therapy.
Exactly.
But the therapists were so full of themselves at the time that in their own books they would write, like, this is how I discovered this. So, you know, the second day this client came in, she seemed angry. And I said, you seem angry. Let's give that feeling state a name. So they'd name it right there. And then, and then every time she appeared angry, they would say, well, that's that name. Oh, now you appear sad. Let's give that a name. And they would describe basically the development of this belief in their client.
The grooming of multiple personalities.
It was so, you know, when you look at it, it's so clearly a grooming. None of these clients came in, you know, as they admitted themselves, that none of them came in displaying these symptoms. It was a matter of, like, pulling them out over a long period of therapy, which, if you look at it another way, is just simply a matter of belief building and social pressure. I mean, and indeed, once these clients get out from under this particular therapist, these ideas tend to fade. And generationally, certainly, it's faded out remarkably.
Well, the profession's sick on some, often on the psychotherapy side as well as on the psychiatric drug side.
But, I'm a I'm a critic in several different ways. Even though I'm tremendously impressed by people within the profession as well, and I'm, you know, certainly most of the people, the heroes in my current book, the Crazy Like Us, are indeed themselves, you know, psychologists and cross-cultural psychiatrists and people who are trying to sort of understand these differences before, you know, globalization begins to erase these different conceptions of the human mind. And it really is going to be a loss to humanity if we win the battle, you know, as, you know, you're selling this idea, our ideas about,
well,
you know, what mental illness is.
Making. And it's going to be wonderful for the pharmaceutical industry. All of this is driven ultimately by the pharmaceutical industry with the collaboration of the medical professions.
And they're very good at it. Indeed, the first, you know, the reason I wanted to write this book was I sat down one day, I was up in McGill University doing another story, and I sat down with Lawrence Kermayer, who's a cross-cultural psychiatrist up there, and he told me this remarkable story about being invited by GlaxoSmithKline in 2000 to Japan to have a, you know, a conference. And, you know, as you know, it's not uncommon for for these drug companies to throw these conferences, and he accepted the invitation, and he got in, and the first indication it was not like another conference was when the plane ticket arrived. It was a first class plane ticket to Japan. He got there, he was put up in this palatial hotel. He said it was like the Gordon Gekko treatment, like, you know, from Wall Street. It was unlike anything he'd ever done. And he found out this conference was for just a half dozen or so of the most preeminent people in cross-cultural psychiatry. And it was with the main brain trust of GlaxoSmithKline. And they were interested in discovering what these scholars knew about how culture shapes human notions of depression. And it was very clear that they were intent on taking Plaxil to Japan and changing the cultural notion of sadness in Japan so that it fit the drug that they were selling. And they were doing this very studiously and in a very sophisticated and smart way. And after Lawrence Kermayer told me that story, I thought, well, you know, we have to write this book. I have to write this book.
Yeah.
This is an important story to tell.
That's an important book. Very important book. You're an important guy saying important things. I'm really glad you're out there doing what you're doing. Have you gotten much attack? I think in a lot of ways you couch your positions would deflect some of the attack. But do you get much?
You know, I've written about people who have been, you know, attacked, but they're, you know, being a freelance writer and a sole entity, you know, there's not many ways to get to me. That is, I mean, the normal ways that people are gotten to is through, you know, you lose academic appointments, you lose funding for your trials, you lose, you know, legitimacy. The people at the journals who are under the sway of the drug companies no longer accept your work. There's lots of ways that if you deal in that world.
Journalists do get hurt. They stop getting book reviews. They stop getting invited to give speeches. People don't write about them in the New York Times anymore.
What I found more remarkable, you know, is the ideas in this book seemed, you know, it was the way in which they were accepted was sort of more remarkable to me, because I was certainly ready for a fight when this book came out. And after Making Monsters came out in 1994, that was a horrible fight with the, you know, when I was accused myself of possibly being, you know, a Satanist if I was going to say these things and so forth. It was a bitter fight, and I was ready for a similar battle. But what I found was that people, you know, this idea, people almost immediately accepted the notions that I was saying in the book, but they would say, like, oh, yeah, you know, people are often, but they would accept it about someone else, not themselves. They would say, well,
right,
you know, this
right.
guy down the hall, when he goes, you know, on his international psychosocial interventions, he does it terribly. He doesn't know what he's doing. But when I do it, I really know what I'm doing. I'm culturally sensitive.
Yeah.
And indeed, that may be true, but I think with any criticism, it's easier to see, you know, to apply it to someone else than to apply it to your own
right.
efforts.
Right.
So.
Well, you're doing really important work.
Well, this is a fascinating area. You know, it's I feel so privileged to have taken the two years to learn about it. I got to travel to Japan and Sri Lanka and Zanzibar and talk to these remarkable people about the work that they've done. And I felt, as a journalist, so privileged to be in this area where I felt these there was just remarkable ideas at every turn. And I think we're at an important moment in history to be examining these cross-cultural differences, because there is the chance that they're going to disappear on us in a few generations, or they're going to become so muddled with Western ideas that they become a third thing. And I think before that happens, we really need to look at the value in the different ways other people think about the human mind and the different ways other people think about human illness, because, you know, to be quite honest, we're not doing so great ourselves. We have the most money and attention that goes to mental health, to research, the drugs, to everything, and we have some of the worst outcomes in the world. And we got to look squarely at ourselves and say, perhaps it's time we start, instead of teaching the rest of the world how to think like us, it's perhaps time that we begin to learn from the rest of the world about what they know about the human mind and human connection before we trample all over it.
Right. Well, I think, unfortunately, the intellectual battle gets fought on the sidelines, and the real battle is standing up to the power that the drug companies have been given in our colleges and universities and in our medical schools and our conferences and our daily lives. It's quite astonishing.
Do you feel the tide is turning on this topic? Do you feel like there's a lessening of the drug companies' influence in these areas?
Well, certainly, you know, when I started first talking a lot about these things in the early 90s is when I took on the drug issues and regarding Prozac. Before then, I was doing the antipsychotic drugs, ECT. When I started to take on Prozac, the response, although Talking Back to Prozac was a bestseller, I think it just caught them off guard, so it, you know, it was able to succeed. The attack was so horrendous, and in every possible area, in every possible way. And I think it wasn't just my writing the book. Of course, I was doing legal work. I was an expert against Eli Lilly and so on. I was criticizing the Psychiatric Association, the government, and so on. It's very different now. No one gets attacked that hard anymore. And when I go on the radio, which I do a lot, I mean, last week I was probably on six different radio shows and one television show and got filmed for yet another one, the response that I'm getting is so incredibly positive now. So there's a huge change, first toward me, but I think it's a bigger change toward realizing that the drug companies have too much power, that psychiatry's lost its way, that drugging people, especially on the ends of the age spectrum, the children and the elderly, is really, really bad. So I do think there's a shift in the public. I don't see any shift at all in psychiatry. You know, they may give a little lip service here or there, but in organized psychiatry and medicine and pharmaceutical industry, I think they're going to ramp up. Now, the big hope is that people will just say, no, we're not interested in this anymore. Right. We don't want to drug our children. We don't want kids growing up with their brains damaged by psychoactive substances. We don't want to do that. We want them to grow up to be who they are, not who Prozac is directing them to be, or Ritalin or whatever. So I think it's got to come there, and I don't know if that's going to ever fully happen. Will it be maybe like the Berlin Wall, where there's some critical mass is reached and all of a sudden the pharmaceutical industry and the shrinks are completely marginalized and people are finding other solutions en masse? I don't know whether that's going to happen. But, Ethan, I think it's the only way it's going to happen. I don't think that the pharmaceutical industry or psychiatry is ever going to give up the power it now has.
Right.
It's going to have to be taken from them.
I feel like there's been a shift in the air. I mean, I went to the APA in New Orleans, I think it was just 2 years ago, and the presence of the drug, I mean, there were some major drug companies that did not have a booth on the main floor, you know, which I thought was very, very interesting. And I think there are people within the profession who realize that their legitimacy, such as it is, has been severely damaged by that connection.
So they're toning down the circus, but I'll tell you something, that money's going to go somewhere else.
Yeah. I mean, it's they're not going to give up. And, you know, barring the major lawsuits, and I have to say within the recovered memory controversy, one of the reasons that turned so quickly was there's some major lawsuits against, you know, people that ran these dissociative disorder units. And boy, when the lawyers get involved, a lot of damage has been done, and it's not an effective way to sort of...
Yeah, but those are small fry. I mean, right now the drug companies are swallowing billion-dollar criminal and civil fines from the feds.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether we can make our lawsuits big enough to make them change their minds. I'm thinking it's going to take, you know, people like yourself writing books and people reading them and people... on a cultural, personal, social, family level saying, this is nuts. I'm not going to take psychoactive substances to handle my problems. I'm just not going to do that. I think it's going to take something like that. And I'm certainly not going to give my kids bathe their growing brains in junk.
Right.
So that's interesting that they were toning down the carnival a little bit, is what you're saying, I think.
It appeared to be, although, you know, all these cross-cultural psychiatrists I talked to as I went around the world, I asked them, you know, a variation on this question, which was, how's it going to go in the future? Are we going to see a turning of the tide here? Particularly the psychiatrists I interviewed in Japan asked them about, and they noted a little bit of backlash, but... to a person, they said, you know, this globalization of the Western way of thinking about mental illness and treating it, like, none of them saw it turning back. And the forces
behind
it. Yeah, I
think that's the case. That's right.
Yeah.
It's a new market. Maybe someday we'll begin to see the U.S., Great Britain, Canada, and Australia start to pull away. And then maybe we'll see some slow changes in the other cultures. But... this, the power of this amount of money and the brilliance with which they have devoted themselves to hiding adverse effects, promoting drugs, and what you were describing so graphically, you know, the grooming of a cross-cultural psychiatrist to help them market.
Right.
And if he'd been good enough, they might have made him a vice president or higher.
If he was willing to take that, I mean, I think he feels that, you know, being someone that I admire Lawrence Cromer tremendously. He's done great work in this area. And certainly for him to tell me that story, he feels very sheepish about, you know, his small role in the GlaxoSmithKline conquering of Japan, which indeed they did. Paxil became a bestseller in Japan. Remarkable profits they made in that country. Certainly he feels, I think he could have gotten a job in a second there, but I think he quickly realized that he did not want GlaxoSmithKline as his
bedfellows. You know, I view my own work, Ethan, as this twofold. One is standing up to these horrendous forces in the pharmaceutical industry and organized medicine, the government agencies, and this whole what I call the psychopharmaceutical complex. But the other is to really encourage people to believe in human relationship as the solution to human problems, human relationship to God, too, if you believe that. And I do. I think relationship to God also matters. But it's relationship, and it's about meaningful living and receiving loving, caring help from other human beings. This is what, it's all about. So that's why when I set up a new organization, Ginger and I, we called it the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, because, you know, everybody knows who knows anything about the field knows I've been taking on these other forces. But what really matters is the positive values that we can give each other as human beings.
I couldn't agree more, and I can't tell you, I've enjoyed this discussion so
greatly. Oh, I love
so
this
greatly.
Discussion, yes.
Yeah.
And we're talking to Ethan Waters. The music is here. It means we're coming to an end of what I hope has been a really good conversation. Ethan Waters, Waters, is really, really, really important book, Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter. Take care.